Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. It's 3:06 on a Friday afternoon. The weekend's coming. The weekend's coming. But before we get there, we have a lot to talk about as we come to you live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. As always, my colleague Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, is here. Jim, it's always wonderful to
Great
have
to be
you
here.
Sitting there. He's in the paper, the Dead Tree Edition, on Thursdays and Sundays with his column, and he oversees Political Insider, the blog that you can read on AJC.com every day. We have Mayor Rusty Paul, the mayor of Sandy Springs. Rusty, it's great to have you back. Rusty, we should say that not only are you now mayor of Sandy Springs, you are a longtime leader of the Georgia Republican Party, former chair, and even before that, you were one of Jack Kemp's closest advisors when he ran for president and when he was at the Department of Housing and Urban Development. So thank you for being here,
Mayor.
Good
to be back with you today.
And Dr. Andra Gillespie is back after being gone for a while. We're really happy to have you here, Andra. Thanks so much for joining us. Okay, let's get right to it. The Georgia Republicans, as we said at the beginning of the show, are just, their convention is now underway in Augusta. It's an annual event. And Jim, how much real business transpires here? Explain to everybody.
Usually not a whole lot, but this is an exception. They are actually picking, I think, 31 or 32 delegates and alternates. Those are the last people who will be placed on the train or bus to go to Cleveland.
Yeah, the remaining Georgia delegates to the Republican National Convention will be elected today or tomorrow. I don't know what the schedule is.
They'll be selected tomorrow. And then tomorrow evening, they'll have a little meeting amongst themselves, pick a chairman, and pick some members for the Rules and Platform Committees.
Okay, so there's a lot to talk about in terms of what might transpire out there, including the fact that Governor Deal and David Ralston, two of the highest-ranking officials in the party, are not there. I'm going to be interested in your take on that, Rusty Paul. But let's do this. Greg Bluestein, the political reporter for the AJC, is in Augusta this afternoon, and he's joining us now for a couple of minutes on the phone. Greg, are you with us?
I am. I miss you guys. You could be wandering the sweltering streets of downtown Augusta.
Well, I hope you get to Scogner's Barbecue before the weekend is over.
Greg,
we've been hearing a lot about the disgruntled nature of many of the foot soldiers in the Republican Party, the kind of activists who do, in fact, attend this convention over the governor's veto of campus carry and religious liberty. What's the mood out there in terms of that?
Well, there's a lot of frustration. Remember, just as you said, these are the folks who are willing to trade a beautiful summer weekend to sit in a hotel in the middle of downtown Augusta, talk about exactly that, things like religious liberty veto, things like the campus carry veto, stuff like the Republican Party platform and selecting these remaining 31 delegates. This is the sort of the backbone of the Republican Army in Georgia, and they tend to be a little more conservative than the party at large, and they also are very, very, very sort of dedicated and devoted to the Republican causes.
Hey, Greg, this is Jim here. I got a question for you. Johnny Isaacson has finished speaking, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay, tell me, did he use the name Donald Trump, or did he just say the Republican nominee?
He said Republican nominee several times and spoke sort of at large about the need for another Reagan sort of sunrise in America. So really sort of cast it back three decades in his very, very short address.
Did he do a Paul Ryan? Did he say, I plan to vote for the Republican nominee, or did he leave that out?
He's sidestepping. He gets questioned a lot by us reporter folks about it, but for the most part, in his public addresses, he doesn't mention the top of the ticket. And a few times when he has, he talks about how his number one concern is to preserve the Senate Republican control of the Senate.
May I ask if he asked or specifically mentioned Hillary Clinton?
He did. Hillary Clinton's name is going to be mentioned, I think, more than Donald Trump's this weekend. What I should be doing is counting that mention in just the speeches from sort of minor party functionaries. She's already been mentioned over and over and over again.
Greg, are you sensing out there, we know that among the delegates who've already been selected in the congressional district conventions, that Trump got skunked by the Ted Cruz forces. Even though Trump won the state, Cruz came away with a lion's share of delegates. Is there any remaining resentment? Are there any Ted Cruz for president signs out there? Is there any sense that they're not ready to get behind this nominee at all? Or do you expect this weekend everybody's going to march in lockstep toward Donald Trump?
You know, I'm glad you asked that, because while the leaders of both the Cruz campaign in Georgia and the Marco Rubio campaign of Georgia have both gone on record saying, guys, Trump is the nominee, give up the fight, there's all sorts of rumors here about a secret Cruz slate being circulated, and that there will be some sort of attempt by the Cruz forces to, like, you get at least a few more people who back Cruz. And it's not necessarily for you know, Donald Trump's already clinched the nomination, but the word here is that it's for the next round of the 2020 election, and trying to smooth and clear some of the rules for the nomination in 2020, that could help Ted Cruz. Now, who knows what those rules could be, because the race will be a very different.
Right, race. Right. There's a. It seems as if there's a division between those people who think Donald Trump is representing something completely different, and those who think that he's just leasing the party for a little bit, and they want to be prepared to take the party back once he's gone.
Yeah, and of course, what helps Ted Cruz, you know, what could help, what people think could help Ted Cruz now for 2020 might help someone else in 2020. So who knows?
Greg Bluestein, we really appreciate you joining us for a few minutes. Have a great weekend out there in Augusta. Greg,
thanks. Miss you guys.
And we'll talk to you when you get back. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks.
Rusty, could I turn to you first on this? So we know that the lion's share, as I said, of delegates in the congressional conventions went to Ted Cruz. We can assume, can't we, that that Trump will get the remaining delegates?
Yeah, I think that no matter who they supported in the primaries, when they get to Cleveland, they're going to vote for Donald Trump. But there were some interesting inferences that can be drawn from what Greg just said. And in other words, they're already thinking about 2020. That means a lot of even the grassroots folks have, at some level, kind of written off the 2016 presidential race and are already looking down the road. And I'm hearing a lot of that among not only the grassroots activists, but obviously those who are just a little right of center. I can tell you that there are an enormous number of Republican women who, and some of them live at my house, whenever Donald Trump comes on, the TV goes off. I normally don't use the word unify and Republican in the same sentence, but I think that there is an understanding that Donald Trump cannot help himself, and he's going to, at some point, maybe implode. And the party, both from Paul Ryan, who kind of represents one wing of the party, all the way to those folks in those chairs in Augusta today, are all sensing that this is not going to turn out well, and they're trying to get what they can out of it.
Yeah, what you have to remember is the 2016 GOP presidential contest is being run according to the rules that were established by the 2012 convention, and that's what makes membership on the Rules Committee and Platform Committee so important this year. Because again, it's assumed that Trump will either be president or he will disappear from the scene, and they're trying to create the right ground for the next crop of candidates.
All right, but Jim, if you're operating under the rules of the convention, and any of you can weigh in on this, but that means that the delegates who were elected to give their vote to Ted Cruz should be bound, despite the fact that Trump's the nominee, to vote for Cruz on the first and second ballots? Or how is that going to work? Do they break their vow?
You're bound unless your candidate withdraws.
Well, but he's only he's just suspended his campaign.
Yeah, but
which
in
is
essence, that's a legal.
Okay.
That's a legal hoop that he goes through, so that first of all, if Trump fell over dead, he could come back tomorrow, and also it allows him
to continue raising money.
So,
right.
Sure. He's got debts and other things.
So
it would also be very proper for a delegate to vote for Trump, to whom he is sworn, and then sabotage Trump in another meeting in the Rules Committee.
Right, and that I think that that's actually a really important point. I think we're going to see more of this on the Democratic side just because Bernie Sanders has more votes and therefore has more leverage to go along with this. But what I suspect is that there'll be a lot of delegates who will play along and will say fair is fair. Donald Trump won the primaries, but then they'll do the same thing this time that they did in 2012 and try to create rules that will stop a Donald Trump the same way they tried to stop Ron Paul in 2012.
Well, you know, I've done this for a while now. Yeah. Next year's my 40th year in Republican politics. And I have watched the political class try and manipulate the rules to get outcomes. It never works.
It always seems to go wrong.
You know, look, there's one day every cycle that the politicians have to step aside, and that's election day. And the voters take over, and they work their will no matter what we in the political class do. They're going to make the decision that they want to make no matter how we write the rules.
Andra, I think Jim Galloway said something really interesting as we started the show, and he wrote about this in his column on Thursday. Do Georgia Republicans think that Donald Trump is the future of the Republican Party, or is he renting the party through the 2016 election cycle? That's a really interesting question.
I would say that he's renting the party. And I actually like that. And so I'll give you credit for it, but I'm going to use this one going forward. I think he's renting the party. I think that the party is at a crossroads. And I think the machinations that we're talking about here are reflective of what people think the party is going to go into. Like, I'm not quite sure that Ted Cruz is really the future of the party, even though I know that there are people who are devoted to him who want that to happen. But I think they're going to have to decide what they are. The thing about Trump renting the party, like, even if he's defeated this time, what I think his ego means we probably haven't seen the last of him. And the other thing that I think is actually really interesting about this cycle is I'm not just thinking about him. I'm thinking about the dynastic element of the Trump family. It seems as though a number of the children have gotten the political bug, and I would not be surprised if at some point in the future, Eric or Donald Jr. or Ivanka actually emerged as a political
figure. My money's
figure.
On Ivanka.
Yeah.
Well, let me say this. I think that 2016 marks the end of the Reagan era in Republican politics. I think that you can safely say that. That era started in 1964 with Goldwater that transformed the Republican Party. I think the Republican Party that comes out of 2016 is going to be different than the pre-2016, but I don't know how different it's going
to be. Yeah, well, I'd love for you to drill down on that just a bit. When I hear you say that, the first thing I think about is the ideology of the Reagan era. The conservative ideology is now being challenged by a candidate who seems to have no ideology whatsoever. And the question becomes, but Georgia Republicans who are out in Augusta do have an ideological conviction, right?
No question about it. That's the distilled essence of the ideological base sitting in Augusta this weekend, and that's why I think that we haven't really raised this issue: why the governor's not there and why the speaker's not there.
But if I could just continue that thought, you've also got U.S. Senator David Perdue, who will talk to Republicans on Saturday. He had an op-ed piece on Wednesday in the Washington Post, where he said, "Look, this Trump movement is real. It's changing, and it's something that's bigger than ideology." I thought that was a really interesting
line. And I agree with that. That's the reason I say that the Republican Party that comes out of 2016 is going to be different than the party of 2016 for that very reason.
Yeah, you know, and one of the things that's interesting is that we would look at somebody like Donald Trump in political science and say that he's ideologically unconstrained because we have in our heads which ideas go together. And now we're learning that different ideas fit together, and I think we're just figuring out how to measure those things.
All right, let's get to the question that Rusty posed, which is the absence of Governor Deal and David Ralston. By the way, you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB, and just to lead us into that conversation, Sam Burnham posted a note on our Twitter saying, "What will it really accomplish if the GOP convention chooses to censure Governor Deal? Seems like a silly and empty vengeance." But we do censure is the, I mean, we've all tried to find a word because there is no formal censure that the party can bring to bear.
They may pass a resolution and it may mention him by name or mention him by position. I think what they're going to try to do is tuck it away toward the very, very end of the convention and do it on, say, a hand vote or a standing vote where nobody is pinned down and go home. No, there's without debate.
Well, I tell you, it's there's always been this disconnect within the Georgia Republican Party. I mean, we all remember Saxby Chambliss being booed several years ago. There is this kind of love-hate relationship between the Republican base and its elected officials. And the elected officials represent a broader spectrum of people than the people who are sitting in that chair. And that's the dichotomy that the David Rawlsons and the Nathan Deals live with day in and day out, because a large percentage of the Republican coalition is not sitting in those chairs at the convention in Augusta. And they have to pay attention to the full coalition. And my concern about the Republican Party is we're spending an awful lot of time arguing over a shrinking piece of real estate. And the party is shrinking. The number of groups that we appeal to is shrinking. And elected officials have to get 50% plus one. And so they're in a different mindset. It used to be the role of a party was to elect people to office. That was its only function. Now it's more of an ideological debating society, and winning elections becomes less of an issue.
Interesting. Andra, another thing that Jim pointed out in his column that I again thought was fascinating, because it's just, if you haven't seen this column, you can go to the Political Insider blog, right, Jim?
And AJC.com.
It's posted there. He made an interesting point that I'd love to get you to respond to. He said, without a Nathan Deal and a David Ralston there, this convention can go off the rails at any moment. There's no leadership there to sort of hold everything together.
Well, I mean, so, you know, if I were thinking about this as a political scientist, this is the time where we start talking about the decline of parties. And so we're definitely not where we were 50 years ago, where you have strong parties, where a lot of this stuff would be controlled, where you wouldn't have had the primary system that we had today. And so you could actually kind of keep people in line and there was a certain amount of discipline. So we're definitely in an era where personalities reign and where people can actually elide the formal party structure in order to get things done that they want to. And I think that that's actually particularly important as we consider the future of the Republican Party and what the viability of the party is now. So not just changing demographics, but whether or not there is an ideology, an idea, or a person who could actually unify people together around something that actually maybe not even in name, but also not in form, look like what we know to be the Republican Party today.
Right, and for the last 14 years, that role has kind of fallen to the governor,
yeah,
who goes in front of this body 3 years out of every four, and tells them, whether it's Sonny Perdue or Nathan Deal, that yes, this passion is good. But you have to keep the passion reign. You have to act. You have to govern.
Right.
And that's the important thing.
Rusty, having stood at that podium with a gavel in your hand, how challenging a role does the chair have at this convention in terms of trying to keep this convention moving in a direction that there will be positive messaging coming out of it?
Well, when I was party chairman and they asked me what the role of the party chairman is, I said, my job is to change the subject. Republicans agree on about 80%, but when we get off into that 20% that we disagree on, the role of the chairman is to get everybody talking about what we agree on. And that's the challenge that the chairman has. And if you don't have a chair who understands that process, you end up losing total control of your conventions. And I like John Padgett. He's a good guy. Sue Everhart before that, great friends of mine, wonderful people. But we've had a leadership issue. I mean, one of the reasons that Nathan has had this love-hate relationship, you remember that Sue Everhart tried to get him removed as the nominee of the party when he had those issues. And
Nathan Deal tried to remove Sue Everhart.
Yeah, I know. So, you know, they've had this kind of, from the very first day, I mean, I was chairman when Nathan switched parties. I got a phone call from Newt saying, hey, you got to go talk to a good friend of mine who was running for Congress and said he can't run for Congress anymore. And I had to go make that conversation. Yeah. And so I've been there at the birth. And Nathan has had this kind of challenge within the Republican Party. I think he's been a great governor personally. I think he's done a magnificent job of balancing these conflicting agendas. But he had a couple that he had. I mean, he had to do what he did, or the economy of the state would suffer. But this is not new. This is not new.
Before we go to a break, let's finish up on the convention. Jim, in the absence of the governor and David Ralston, one of the highest profile state Republican officials who will be in Augusta is Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle. And he's pretty well this past session threw in his lot with the most conservative elements of the party. He'll be out there talking like a guy who wants to win him to his gubernatorial campaign.
Right, right. 2018 is close upon us. He is, Casey Cagle has really kind of became the champion of the conservative Christian movement in the state capitol, which is ironic in itself, simply because he became lieutenant governor by defeating Ralph Reed back in 2006.
Right, and so, now the Faith and Freedom Coalition
so
is
there's some
his
rapprochement going on here.
What's also ironic, Andre, is Casey Cagle for quite a long time was seen as the guy who upheld the best interests of the business community at the state capitol on neither religious liberty or campus carry, which he touted heavily. Is that something the business community wished he'd been involved with?
You know, I think this is going to be interesting. So I think, you know, there are passions that are inflamed over this issue, so it makes sense that you would kind of go to the place where there appears to be the most heat and want to consolidate that particular group because it's such an important base to the Republican Party and it's such an important base here in Georgia. Say he were to get elected governor, then it becomes a question of how he would in fact govern and whether or not people would then hold him to the same standard or whether they would be okay if he does in fact choose to compromise later.
Okay, well, we're going to watch the birth of a potential gubernatorial campaign. Is Sam Olens out there this weekend? I haven't seen that, to be quite honest with you.
To be honest, I don't know.
All right, we'll see if he shows up out there or not. He's also talked up as a candidate for governor. Jim Galloway shaking his head. I think you're probably right, Jim. All right, let's take a break. It's 3:28 on Friday afternoon. When we come back, we've got to talk about presidential because exciting things are happening on the Republican and Democratic sides of the race. And then we've got some really interesting local issues later in the show that we want to address. But you're listening to Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
Looking at this week's news, the best approach is not to look at this week's news. Just think about something pleasant instead. How about musicians? They're nice. I'm Peter Sagal. Take a vacation with us from The Current Predicament with interviews with Esperanza Spalding, Jewel, Max Weinberg, and others on this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Join us for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me tomorrow morning at 10 and Sunday afternoon at 4 right here on GPB. Thank you for listening to Georgia Public Broadcasting, an 18-station radio network. You're listening to Political Rewind. I'm Ellen Reinhart. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, collaborating with universities in China, Korea, Turkey, Brazil, and South Africa.
Thank you, Ellen Reinhart, who is without question the heartbeat of the newsroom here at Georgia Public Broadcasting. So we've got Jim Galloway from the AJC. We've got Mayor Rusty Paul of Sandy Springs, longtime Republican leader in the state. Although it's probably not fair. Do you want to be characterized that way these days, or do you just like being Mayor Paul, living in your own little world up there?
I like the flexibility of taking on the identity that I choose.
I think mayor is a nonpartisan position.
There you go.
When I need to be nonpartisan, I'm mayor.
He's always been one of the smartest guys that we talk to. And Dr. Andre Gillespie, who is an associate professor of political science.
Hey, before we get, we need to grill our Republican here.
Would you like to? I'll tell you what. I'm going to walk out of the studio. You're in charge.
Okay. Rusty?
Yeah.
Are you going to vote for Donald Trump?
Yeah, Rusty.
You know, my daughter asked me that very same question. I told her that when I go into the voting booth, that it's a very private moment. And I have done interesting things in there that my family probably doesn't know that I've done. I tend to vote for the Republican nominee. I almost always have voted for the Republican nominee. Sometime in early November, after listening to all the discussion, I will do some heart-to-heart conversation with myself and make a decision then.
Rusty, is it appropriate on Election Day in November to not cast a ballot for President of the United States and just vote in the down-ballot races?
There are some races that I have in the past skipped because I knew the people in my party all too well. And my boss, Jack Kemp, who you referenced earlier, always told me you serve your party best by serving your country first. And just because you're Republican or Democrat or Libertarian doesn't automatically qualify you, in my opinion. Now, I will say this, 99.9% of my votes have always been Republican, but there are some cases where I have chosen not to exercise that option.
All right. Well, I wasn't going to go there quite yet, but, Andre, did you want to jump in?
I mean, this raises a really important point for people. So their messages are conveyed when people don't vote. So I think it's a huge risk when you don't show up at all, and especially if you have a pattern of not showing up at all. So that level of apathy probably doesn't get the type of response from elected officials that you want. However, if reliable groups of people choose to stay home or choose to refuse to vote on in certain races, that conveys a message, and the party and candidates need to respond to that.
Well, that was the argument 4 years ago that Mitt Romney lost mostly because evangelicals stayed home, didn't vote. You go back and you look at some key states, and Andre's right. You can exercise your choice by not choosing. That is always a choice.
Well, I wanted, before we ask that question, to point out, Jim, that he is not the first Republican panelist on the show to have to squirm a little in his chair
over this question. This is the fun part of this program.
Well, as I've said, the party that I started out with this year will be different than the party at the end of the year. I'm not sure exactly how it's going to play out. A lot will determine who his vice presidential nominee is. A lot will determine how he manages his volatility during the next several months. He hasn't been able to do that. And when we get into the Hillary Clinton discussion, I think they found his Achilles heel. The question is he going to play into their hands, or is he going to adapt? Those are key questions that I, as a Republican, have to observe.
And we're going to get into exactly those questions. But first, we got a tweet from some guy who tweets at Lord Tinsdale.
Oh, I can't imagine who that is.
I think that's our friend Brian Robinson, who says, great and accurate comments on Politics GPB by Rusty Paul about Nathan Deal's relationship with the state party. So Brian's in your corner on this one.
Well, I've watched it up close and personal and from a distance, and it's,
All right, let's move on to presidential. Andre, let me start with you on this, if I may. There are many people who believe that yesterday was a seminal moment in what we presume is going to be the general election campaign between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And we'll talk in a few minutes about the fact that New Jersey and California are going to determine that. And by the middle of next week, she's probably the nominee of the party, right? She has enough delegates. So we'll park that for a moment. Was it a seminal moment? She gave a long, very carefully written, and on both sides of the aisle, people seem to agree, a very calmly delivered speech. Supposed to be a foreign policy speech. It was clearly a speech about her opponent, Donald Trump. Was it a seminal moment?
I'm not sure about that yet. I would say that Donald Trump had a bad week. I think he's behaved very badly this week, even for Donald Trump. However, that has not seemed to affect him at all. And so I'm not sure he still doesn't have his Teflon yet. So we're going to need a little bit more data out in order to know that for sure. So here's part of the reason why I think he may still have Teflon, even though I am willing to be disproved by the data. The frames where he gets his righteous indignation are against groups that people in his camp actually really can't stand. And so that might actually buoy the support for him in those groups. So, his intemperate attack against journalists for no reason, that was completely below the belt. Well, he's attacking the media, so people don't like the media. And if you don't like the media, you might be inclined to not support Donald Trump anyway.
All right. So you've set the table for a really good conversation. Before we get to it, let's listen to just about a minute of a compilation of some of what Hillary Clinton said yesterday.
I believe in strong alliances, clarity in dealing with our rivals, and a rock-solid commitment to the values that have always made America great. Donald Trump's ideas aren't just different. They are dangerously incoherent. They're not even really ideas, just a series of bizarre rants, personal feuds, and outright lies. He is not just unprepared. He is temperamentally unfit This is not someone who should ever have the nuclear codes, because it's not hard to imagine Donald Trump leading us into a war just because somebody got under his very thin skin. I will leave it to the psychiatrist to explain his affection for tyrants. He praises dictators like Vladimir Putin and picks fights with our friends, including the British Prime Minister, the Mayor of London, the German Chancellor, the President of Mexico, and the Pope.
So, Jim Galloway, just if you don't mind, I'm going to kind of ask you to respond to something, and then you'll go on with whatever else you want to say. During the primary campaign, there was a lot of criticism of the other Republican candidates that they never really confronted Trump in the way that was necessary to undermine his message. Now, I would argue that that kind of confrontation really isn't going to work until you get to a general election campaign when there are only two candidates and the spotlight is brightly lit on that Republican candidate. Clinton yesterday really laid out the argument she's going to make in the general election campaign, and that's much different than if you're Jeb Bush on a stage with 14 or 15 other candidates, right?
Right, right, right. One of my favorite pieces of election year literature is Fear and Loathing on the campaign trail.
Hunter Thompson.
Right. For the last 6 months, Republicans have made it clear that loathing is their trademark, loathing of Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton just seized fear. She is going to be, it's clear, dangerously incoherent is a very powerful phrase.
But, I mean, the thing that I worry about, though, is whether or not she's preaching to her choir. And so the people who are nodding in agreement and are going right on are the people who are already probably inclined to vote for her.
Right. Foreign policy isn't always a mover in elections.
Right. No, I mean, I think, you know, temperament is an accurate way to go against him. But people have been trying this before. He's behaved badly and it hasn't hurt him yet. Well, so I'm still, I guess my margin of error is still kind of there to go, okay, so how are people actually going to respond? And so I'm still kind of in a wait and see mode about what it's actually going to take to actually really bring him down.
Well, let me give the Republican perspective on Hillary's attack yesterday. I think it was effective from this point on a couple of reasons. Last time I was here, I said that Hillary's problem is she gives speeches rather than talking to her audience. If you listen to her tone and watch her yesterday, she was talking. She wasn't in an attack mode. She's just having a conversation with her audience. That's a change in tone for her. And I think she was much more effective as a result. But as we all know, general elections are not about the base. You've got your base or you wouldn't be where you are. It's about those swing voters and those independent voters. And that's where this now begins to hinge. Who has the best message for that group of people? And I think that's the real challenge. I mean, Paul Manafort, who's is an old friend of mine. He and Charlie Black and Roger Stone, all friends of mine.
Of whom have been working in one capacity or another on the Trump campaign. Trump,
and they know what has to be done, but they have not been able to get him to do it yet, to move from the primary mode where he was successful into that general election mode where you've got to talk to that narrower group of people.
All right, so I would throw this out. There is certainly, if we're talking about now who the voters are who can be moved one direction or the other, goodness knows there will be plenty of ammunition for the Trump campaign to use against Hillary Clinton to try to persuade that group of people out there who will make the difference. On the other hand, I would take issue with what Andra said, Jim. I thought yesterday Hillary Clinton's message was pointed at those independents, those suburban women. I don't think it was a basement message.
No, it was. I would say that was aimed at people, especially in California, who might be uncomfortable with where Donald Trump may be taking us. Do keep in mind, throughout that speech, she referred to him not as Mr. Trump, as he likes to be called, but Donald. It was always Donald.
Yeah, I thought that was fascinating, too. Do you want to respond to my concerns?
No, I mean, I hear your point, and I think that was absolutely her strategy. But I think I'm probably reluctant to say that that worked without evidence, because people have tried this before, and it's everything has seemed perfectly rational to me, and it just hasn't seemed to work.
Great point. And just another reason why political scientists are always such a fly in the ointment. They want data. They want facts.
But I will say one thing. You know, we've had two Republican presidents, Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush, whose grasp of foreign policy issues were questioned during the campaign. And they always seemed to overcome it through the strength of their personality. Maybe they didn't know all the facts, maybe they didn't know who was running Kyrgyzstan at the time, but they had a personality that allowed people to trust them.
I do not believe that what Hillary Clinton did yesterday was challenge Donald Trump on the basis of his knowledge of foreign
policy. No, but that's my point. No, that's my point. She undercut his personality.
Okay, thank you.
Where I was going with this.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. Let's listen. Okay, so let's compare and contrast. So you heard Hillary Clinton, rather calm and deliberative speech. Donald Trump is Donald Trump, and he has had enormous success with the sort of approach that he took in response to her speech.
I watched Hillary today. It was pathetic. It was pathetic. She's up there and supposed to be a foreign policy speech. It was a political speech. Had nothing to do with foreign policy. She made a political speech tonight, folks, and it was a pretty pathetic deal. When you watched her today, she does not look presidential. That I can tell you. She doesn't. Anything Obama wants, she's going forward with, because you know why? She doesn't want to go to jail. That's why, folks. That's why.
Rusty, could we do a quick thought experiment?
Sure.
So you're Paul Ryan for the next couple of minutes. You've just said...
Another Kemp acolyte, I might add.
There you go. You've just announced that you were going to vote for Donald Trump. Not a full-throated endorsement, but an endorsement nevertheless. And you then sit back and watch the Hillary Clinton speech and then hear your candidate, Donald Trump, respond. Do you wish maybe you'd held off on that statement for another week?
No, Paul had absolutely no choice. I mean, the truth is, as the number three Republican leader, and maybe not, probably number two, given as Speaker of the House behind the nominee, he's getting pressure from his caucus to step up. So the one thing that a Speaker or a majority leader in a legislative body is most concerned with is keeping his troops happy. And so he had to do what he did. The real issue, I think, it's going to be an interesting election. First of all, you've got two candidates who are probably the most unlikable candidates that the American public's had to choose between in quite a while. And there was something that was interesting that was announced yesterday, that Humana is going to have a huge hike in their medical rates because of losses related to Obamacare. Now, the question is, just as people are going to the polls in November, they're going to get their notices about these huge health care increases. What impact is that going to have in this process? So that's the reason I'm saying I'm waiting until November to begin to see how all this stuff sorts out.
Andra, to reinforce your wait-and-see approach, we have Marie, who tweets at KDPW, saying, how can she, obviously referring to Clinton, call him a risk when she, in all caps, is under criminal, in all caps, investigations?
Right. I mean, so these are just incredibly polarizing candidates. And so I think the question is, well, how big is the center? And so if that center is really, really small, then it's going to be really hard for them to figure out exactly sort of who they are and then how to appeal to them.
Okay. So if I can, I want to, I think we have a tweet from Ted Barfield, who says, I'm not a Trump supporter, but the notion that he has no basis for attacking the press is laughable. And there's already been a mention over there, Andra, about the media and how Trump has dealt with it. I want to ask you, excuse me, I'm going to grab something. The New York Times had a piece this morning that relates to some of what happened with Trump in this past week. Donald J. Trump's blustery attacks on the press, complaints about the judicial system, and bold claims of presidential powers collectively sketch out a constitutional worldview that shows contempt for the First Amendment, the separation of powers, and the rule of law, legal experts across the political spectrum say. So he attacked the federal judge who's hearing the Trump University case. He, of course, had the news conference in which he called reporters sleazes and whatever. Is there a reason to be concerned that among that base, he is establishing a tone that is, in fact, going to lead people to disregard the very foundations of what this country is supposedly built on?
Well, I think so. You know, I said at a conference a few months ago that I might sound like a Tea Partier when I say this, but I have concerns about Donald Trump's respect for the Constitution. I think that that's a legitimate concern. And so maybe that argument can be persuasive to some people. But if you just want an outsider because you think any outsider will be better than the normal kind of hoi polloi in politics, then that argument may not be persuasive at all.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that I'm concerned about, is that the what seems logical to us, you know, who follow this regularly, might not resonate in the same way with your average voter.
Yeah, Jim, certainly attacking the media isn't going to cost him much in the way of support out there.
No, but you do have a media that's getting a good deal more aggressive, specifically when it comes to Trump University. That's something we understand. We know numbers. We know tax returns. We can follow numbers. But again, that headline in the New York Times today, Donald Trump could threaten U.S. rule of law. That's a pretty big topic, and that was a news story. That was not an editorial.
Yeah, I think, and you know what, Rusty? Here's another thing, and we've all known each other for a long time, Jim Galloway, you and I. Andre's just getting to know you now. But we've known you as a political leader who we've covered as a politician. There's always this talk about how we're all liberals in the journalism world, and some are and some aren't. I've voted both sides. I think there's something else at work, and I'd love your response to it. When Trump goes after the media as viciously as he has, I think if there's ever a bias, it has more to do with how well can we work with a political guy, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat. If you're being attacked by a candidate you're covering all the time, even if it's somebody who you don't philosophically agree with, or you do agree with, it's hard to get past a personal reaction to that person. And I wonder if Trump's not setting that up to really inspire even more aggressiveness, as Galloway is describing.
Well, I've been covered. You guys have covered me now in one form or another for a number of decades. And I'll have to say that the coverage I get has not always been positive, but it's been fair. And that's all I've ever asked out of a reporter, is just to be fair. And Jim covered me on an issue earlier this year that was very painful, but he was fair. And so that's kind of what your job is to do, is to try and ferret out the news. I mean, you've got to sell newspapers and you got to get ratings and so on. But Trump on the Constitution, I've listened to politicians say for generations, I'm going to Washington, I'm going to fix Washington. The only way you can fix Washington is to tear up the Constitution and throw it away, because it was built broken. It was built by people who didn't trust the government, and they fixed it where nobody could do anything unless you have a significant consensus. And we don't have consensus in this country on any major topic, so we have stalemate. But that's the real concern, I think, that a lot of people looking at Trump, does he really understand the foundations of our system?
Yeah.
And I hate to say that as somebody who ought to be – I've spent my life defending Republicans who sometimes were hard to defend.
All right. We've got to get another break in. It's 3:49 on Friday afternoon. When we come back, Andre, I want to start with you, if I can. We really do need to figure out, once Hillary Clinton secures the nomination, which seems inevitable next week, what the heck does Bernie Sanders do? Let's take a break and come back and discuss that.
After NPR and Frontline's reporting on the National Flood Insurance Program, FEMA announced sweeping reforms. But not everyone is impressed.
It is too little too late. FEMA has basically turned over this program to the private insurance companies.
An update on the business of disaster next time on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered today from 4 until 7 on GPB.
We're back on Political Rewind. Mayor Rusty Paul, Sandy Springs, Dr. Andre Gillespie, Emory University, Jim Galloway of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution at the Political Rewind table today. So, Andra, New Jersey, California, the big states that vote on Tuesday, the interesting scenario there is that New Jersey closes its polls, obviously, well ahead of California. And by the time California returns come in, we could have projections of Clinton winning enough delegates in New Jersey to be over the top.
It's a winner-take-all state.
Right. But she then potential for her to lose California. What does that scenario feel like to you?
It's an optical blow, but she will have likely made her acceptance speech before the California returns come in. And so, especially for those of us who are on the East Coast, it might be kind of late. And so many people might not be paying as much attention by the time it's 10 or 11 o'clock at night than we would have been at 7 or 8 o'clock at night when we should know whether or not Hillary Clinton has won New Jersey. It's an optical blow. It reinforces this notion that she is a weak nominee. It sort of reinforces the narrative that she's unlikable and that there are problems within the Democratic Party. And it raises these issues about mobilization and about whether or not she's actually able to reconcile with the progressive wing of the party, some of whom might be more interested in voting for Donald Trump than voting for her as the nominee.
So, Jim, we do expect the polls show us that she's way out in front in New Jersey. California's a little more up in the air right now. There are polls that are kind of all over the map, but most of them show that it's a pretty tight race between the two of them, although it's going to be decided in terms of delegates on congressional districts.
Right, and she and Bill are, I think that they've got something like 30 events scheduled between now and Tuesday, so they are making a very, very big play for it. I also think that that you have to remember that Donald Trump has already secured his nomination, and yet yesterday he was in San Jose. And you have to wonder whether he is trying to help Bernie just a little bit by beating down Hillary a little.
Well, I think he's sending, don't you, Rusty, the signal that I'm going to put California in play if I can in November. That would be unusual and unlikely, but he's the unlikely and unusual candidate.
Well, as somebody who's run a lot of campaigns on the Republican side, the fact that they're currently, you've got states like Ohio, Pennsylvania, where he's appealed to blue-collar, old-style Republican or old-style Reagan Democrats, have put some of those states in play. I think that if Trump is transformative in any way, it's going to be opening up opportunities for Republicans to go after voters in some states where we haven't had an opportunity to go after.
That gives me an opening. We're going to tweet out later on a link to a New York Times piece that shows the electoral map that Clinton and Trump are likely to face in the fall. And it's really interesting because it suggests that Even if he changes the scenario, it's going to be very difficult for him to put together 270 electoral votes. So we'll find that link and tweet it out. You should all look for that. Andra, what does Bernie Sanders want?
He wants leverage on the party platform. I think there are a couple of things. There might be, he might be holding out for that small probability that Hillary Clinton's campaign completely implodes, the remote chance that she gets indicted for something and ends up having to drop out of the race. But, his goal and his role in this race the entire time was to push the party further to the left. So he wants to push you away from the center, from the more corporate neoliberal type of Democratic Party politics, to something that's much more progressive.
All right, so let me ask you a question, and everybody else can weigh in, although we're running short on time. Okay, so Jewish voters in this country have typically trended Democratic, although there are some significant changes. For instance, Bernie Marcus, right here in Atlanta, is a big, big Republican donor and has indicated this week he's going to give money to Donald Trump. Yeah. Okay, so Sanders appoints to the platform committee. Thanks, two people whose credentials of being somewhat anti-Israel are fairly well established. Cornel West is a supporter of the anti-Israel business. Boycott businesses that live in Israel. And the head of the Arab American, whatever the rest of that organization is, he's introducing a pro-Palestinian message to the Democratic Platform Committee. What is that going to do to the Jewish base of the party?
I think that's an interesting question. I think that that's one that would remain to be seen on this. One, I would assume that Hillary Clinton is probably quietly assuring her supporters of Israel and her base that she's going to try to blunt the impact of those groups. And so maybe you could spin it that Cornel West is going to be thinking more about corporate things. But what this also reflects is that, one, the progressive voices are getting a bigger voice. There are younger voices, more minority voices that are becoming more vocally pro-Palestinian. And so Sanders's voice reflects that. I mean, there was also an article in the New York Times that talked about changing views on Israel within the American Jewish community. And so, you know, this reminds us that we can't view Jewish views on Israel as being completely monolithic as well.
No. What was in Bernie Sanders also went after the co-chairs of both the resolution and platform committees, specifically Dan Malloy of
Connecticut.
Just remember that the co-chair on that platform with Malloy is Shirley Franklin. So she's going to be very deeply involved in this discussion and trying to strike that balance between the Bernie and Clinton forces.
And some of those things, if you look at Israel right now, they're hedging their bets a little bit. I mean, if you notice in the Wall Street Journal, there's a lot of Chinese activity. I was at the Israeli-American Chamber of Commerce meeting last night. A lot of discussion about the number of Chinese who are in Israel. And there's real concern in Israel. U.S. has been a staunch supporter of Israel since Ben-Gurion. And there's a lot of concern in Israel today about how reliable the Americans are, and they're beginning to hedge their bets and cozying up to China.
Yes, but if you're a Republican, you've got to look at the potential that the Democratic Party may start tilting a little bit more. They're not going to become anti-Israel, but if there's a sense in the community out there, the Jewish community, that maybe Republicans, although Donald Trump hasn't made all the right comments about Israel.
But why do you think I was at the American-Israeli Chamber of Commerce last night? I think there's a real opportunity for Republicans that is the strong base of support for Israel today, and I think that more and more Jewish voters are looking that way.
All right. I have a long list of items I had hoped we were going to get to. We're not going to have time. We're really running out of time again because this has been such a really interesting discussion. My thanks to Mayor Rusty Paul of Sandy Springs, to Dr. Andra Gillespie of Emory University, and to Jim Galloway of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. A couple of program notes before we leave you. First, Jim Galloway, next Wednesday, we're going to have a little matchup here. Sparring between Senator Josh McCoon, one of the strongest supporters of religious liberty in the state legislature, squaring off against Brian Robinson, our political insider, who really doesn't agree with him at all.
My job is to bring the popcorn.
That's next Wednesday.
You can sell tickets and raise money.
Oh, it ought to be fun. It ought to be fun. That's next Wednesday at 2 o'clock. A couple of other things we want to point out to you. We're going to be back. We just happen to have a lot of programming right now with the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library. Next Thursday evening, June 9th, we're going to be talking with Sebastian Younger. Last time that we talked about this Wednesday, I couldn't remember the name of the book that put him on the map. It was The Perfect Storm, a mega hit. And he's been selling books fast and furious ever since. His new one, Tribes, is about how the United States is welcoming back veterans who have been in Iraq, Afghanistan, and whether this country is doing the right thing by our veterans. This is going to be a fascinating conversation. I think on our website you'll find a link. This is a ticketed event. You've got to buy tickets for it. Finally, over the weekend on Two-Way Street, a really fascinating conversation with Ambassador Andrew Young. His spiritual growth, how he became active in social justice, I think you'll find it fascinating. So listen in. I'm Bill Nigut. That's it. Have a great weekend. See you next Wednesday on Political Rewind.